come to Art 9, and we need to untie a knot today and retie it as a bow. It's about that kind of image of the way in which art works or doesn't work. And one of the crucial things that we've learned in the history of civilization is that when art doesn't work, then dogma does. And when art works, dogma has a very difficult time getting traction. So there's a direct relationship between art and civilization. Cultures do not need high art to survive, but refined high art is essential to civilizations. Without it, they decay into totalitarian dictatorships without anybody needing to do anything. It's a pattern which repeats itself so regularly that by now, people who study such things have come to be like doctors who can make a diagnosis. And the health of art is the temperature of the patient. And you can tell if somebody's getting sick. And of course, in our own time, we live in a time where the fever is 108. So it's incumbent in some large, serious way to understand it. But also, we need to pay attention to the fact that we're doing personal development here. That this education is a pattern for us as people. But here, too, art is indispensable because the whole functioning of art as a real event registering objectively is the way in which the person becomes objective. And to mistake this actuality, the objectivity of the person, is to open the door to a characteristic slide. Freud called it a regression, which is a mild term for actually the perniciousness of what happens. If the person is not objective, then the person becomes a subjective what if. And the only way to firm up the projection of the subjective what if is to firm up the dogma, the rules, the principles. And so all of the effort of intelligence goes into making sure that the rules cover everything. And you have what's known as a rule of law. There's a famous little dialogue in the film A Man for All Seasons. Robert Bolt put it in, which was a dialogue originally written by one of the protagonists of the real historical events recorded in Man for All Seasons, Sir Thomas More, later on called St. Thomas More because he was martyred. The little dialogue in the film, the son-in-law says to Paul Schofield, who's playing Sir Thomas More, "Why don't you stand up to these unjust laws and do away with this whole tyranny?" And Robert Bolt, Schofield, Sir Thomas More, St. Thomas More replies, "We must sacrifice ourselves to the rule of law, because if someone cuts down the forest of laws, no one would be able to stand up to the fierce winds that would blow." This is a misconception on a major point of human intelligence. It's a point which St. Thomas More never would have picked up or detected, whereas Sir Thomas More knew better. The point is one of allegiance to a religious ordination rather than of allegiance to personal creativity and development. The obverse of that is the great critical scam that one finds enshrined forever in its great archetypal form in John Milton's great poetic epic, Paradise Lost. The great individualist is Lucifer, and that's his sin. Whereas people like William Blake, coming later, said, you know, Milton was of the devil's party, but he didn't really know it. The most colorful figure in Paradise Lost is the fallen Lucifer. And in Blake's time, he becomes a paradigm for the romantic hero who fights against the tyranny, against all odds, even knowing he is going to lose, even knowing he's going to be an exile for all eternity in pain. What is his phrase in Milton? It's better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven. I'd rather be myself, eternally damned, than to be damned subservient eternally. It's this kind of wobble, flip-flop, that makes it so difficult. And even in our time, someone as artistically individual as Igor Stravinsky was on tyranny's side without knowing it many times. Though the artist in him was so great, the individual creative genius was so great that he very frequently, fortunately for us, transgressed against his own better judgment. We're going to use Stravinsky. We're going to use his beautiful, very clear, controversial statements, his Poetics of Music. It's a series of lectures given at Harvard, given in the winter of 1939-1940. So he gave these lectures at a time when the Nazi war machine was just simply running over Europe. And in a way, we have to understand that many of the statements that Stravinsky is making are to disally himself with the great revolutionary power sweeping the world at that time, which was not the French Revolution or the American Revolution, but was the Third Reich. They said, we're the revolutionaries. We're changing everything for the next millennium. And if you want to get in, you better buy stock in our company because we have a monopoly in the future. So many of the things that Stravinsky will say, will write, will publish here, has to be informed by this kind of historical context. Just as we have to understand the historical context of John Milton was that he came in the 17th century in an England that was besieged by civil war, by religious turmoil, by Puritanism, all things to do with purifying the inner to the point to where the traces of ego would vanish completely, of an ideal that held in Milton's time, that the best that Christians could do would be to return back to the primitive early Christianity. It's a great study of Puritanism called To Live Again, the way in which 17th century Puritans tried to relive the lifestyle of the earliest Christians of the first part of the first century. And what happens is that they were successful in this as individuals, but misinterpreted what it meant as a group. Because the earliest Christians indeed led very pure lives. They purified their insides down to zero. The whole development of the concept of shunyata in India does not come from India. It comes from an exposure to Hellenistic Jewish poignancy that St. Thomas brought from the Palestine of the early first century AD. And it registers not in classical northern India first. The idea of Shunyata first comes from South India, where St. Thomas was. If one reviews the Gospel of St. Thomas, the 116 pithy quotations of Jesus, they are all directed towards being seeds that, instead of proliferating into fantastic jungles of association, are meant to collapse to a realization that has no time, no space, no registry whatsoever, a zero point within. In effect, Mahayana Buddhism has a Christian seed, but not a Christian seed in terms of Christianity, but a Hellenistic Jewish seed, but not Judaism. All of that comes from a Pythagorean-informed aesthetic. And all, not even Greek, because that comes from an ancient Egyptian notion. And that in itself comes from a lost antiquity or human beings before there was any kind of surface civilization, developed a civilization in artistic illustrated caves under the earth. If one goes to the earliest Egyptian religious focus, one goes to Abydos, not to Memphis, Cairo, Al-Fustat. And when one goes to the most ancient part of Abydos, one finds that the original first and second dynasty Egyptians, that their place, their focus of worship was the Osirian, which was underground. Osiris is the king of the netherworld. Underground. Civilization was something which grew from a seed that was in the ground, not from the cities that came and sprouted above the ground, or the pyramids that sprouted above the ground. The building of pyramids above the ground is to take the sacred focus, which was in the netherworld, and put it on top of the horizon of the earth, so as to make a transformation that when one comes out of the netherworld, when one is reborn out of the netherworld, you're born on earth. But if you put the tomb, now become a transformational womb, on the earth, when you're reborn into heaven. So the whole object is not to be reborn from the netherworld back onto earth, like come again Pharaoh time, but to be reborn from the earth into eternal heaven. And this is not a simple transposition. It's not just moving the focus one level up. It's going to a completely different order, where one's intelligence now understands that you had the right formula, you had the right sequence, but you were applying it to a very limited perspective. To be rebirthed into life again is a very great ideal of Paleolithic men and women, and even held in Neolithic times. But to symbolically informed men and women, to be simply reborn again and again on earth was rather like a very closed little cycle, because you could apply the same principle of transformation and you could be reborn one time into forever eternity. So why fool around with coming again and again to some limited situation when you could go forever to complete freedom, spiritual freedom? This kind of understanding is not there in Stravinsky, though he approaches it as an artist very frequently during his career, but it is there in the pair that we have to Stravinsky. It's there in Schiller. Schiller's poetry, Schiller's drama, Schiller's philosophy. He even wrote a book on medicine because his father was a great surgeon, and Schiller knew all about doctors. In everything that Schiller wrote, his letters to Goethe, which occupy two huge volumes, everything that Schiller did had to do with making sure that never again would anybody ever mistake the difference between an artist who is objectively real, who's yearning for an objective cosmic eternity, from an artist who's subjectively hoping that he's in alignment with a symbolic objectivity that's tied to a ritual objectivity of the right method. Stravinsky appeals right away in the Poetics of Music to Aristotle's Poetics, to the Greek notion of techne. One has to be technical. One has to understand how you make something, how you make it work. That's right, you do. But differential consciousness objectively works in a completely different way from the tribal integration that's firm in ritual and from the mental certainty that's there in symbols. The differential objectivity of the artist person works towards openness, not towards crossing the T's, dotting the I's, putting the commas and periods where there should be, and one then says, this is the clear technical manual. To have a civilization based on technical manuals is a Nazi ideal. I want you to hear it real good. Because when I was a little boy, it was a toss-up whether that was going to be the next millennium or not. And a lot of people died to make sure that that didn't happen. I remember one time talking in Calgary, Alberta, to an old Canadian named Ross. Ross had been raised in the plains of Saskatchewan, and he and all of his other buddies, because in Canada you fought by regiments that everybody from the same area went and fought together as a unit. He said they were sent to Europe in World War I in 1915, fresh off the prairies. He said we were all seasick because we'd never even seen boats before, other than like on the Saskatchewan River or something like that. So they were sick all the way across until some old sea dog said to them, if you will lay on the deck and look at the sky is not moving. So he said that was the only cure for them. So all the Canadians from Saskatchewan were laying there on the deck staring at the blue sky and to keep from being seasick. And he said it came in very handy in that trench warfare of the First World War because you always had this image within you that you had learned to have an open sky in your mind when you were that sick, frightened, terrified. He told me, he said, he was glad that he didn't have to go and fight the Second World War because he said, I know how tough the Germans were in the First World War and the Nazis were much tougher. They came within a hair's breadth of being successful. Had England have fallen, the whole thing would have been over. This entire complex of events and situations, dogma, doctrine, ideas, possibilities, hope, all of it has been thrust into mid-air suspension, as if it's been thrown into the air. And by the laws of gravity and nature, it now has to come down. And in this generation, right now, somebody either has to catch that ball or it'll explode. It's that kind of situation. It's coming down, that whole ball of wax. This education is meant not only to allow you to catch that ball, so to speak, but to make and generate a population of people who can play catch with that kind of a ball and never ever again be terrified or threatened by the knots of history. There was a long time in our past where human beings were never terrified by history. They were never bothered by history. It wasn't until about 5,000 years ago that men and women began even to be aware that there was such a palpable energy flow as history. And even today, 5,000 years later, almost no one recognizes that the flow of history is a transformational plasma which is not objective, but is very dynamically formative. That history is the equal to nature. It's the equal to vision. It's the equal to language. It's one of the four great dynamic flow processes of reality. And it must be handled the way in which any oceanic flow needs to be handled. It has to be worked with in its own terms. The only viable objective actor in history is the person. The spiritual person, the artist, who is capable of dealing with conscious time-space on an objective level. Because only on the level where conscious time-space is objectified in someone, is there an actor who is free to navigate that ocean of history. No one on the tribal level has a chance. No one on the mental level has a chance, because history is a differential process and doesn't care how you integrate. Your integration techniques are irrelevant to it. Just like your integration techniques are irrelevant to consciousness, to what used to be called magic. You can be the best spear thrower in the tribe. Now you come up against a real magician, your spear isn't going to do you any good. You can be Conan the Invincible in peak form, and one skinny little aged magician can do you in. History is a much more powerful process than magic consciousness. It is titanic. And the only form that objectifies itself out of the power of the flow of history, there's only one form, one and only one, and that is the objective cosmos as a whole. Heaven itself is the only objectivity that is able to precipitate itself out of the flow of history. 5,000 years ago, one finds long before God, long before Yahweh, long before Muhammad or anybody, even Zarathustra, one finds Ra being called the Lord of history. The Lord of millions of years. Because he is able to survive. He's able to rise again. Not just from another world, but he's able to rise from the acid-dissolving process of history. That once one is not only born again and again, which just throws you back into history again and again. Reincarnation is a very paltry thing. Whereas eternal life is objectively real, is there. I hope it doesn't sound like a priest or preacher. It's not meant to be. Just an educator pointing out all of these kinds of phrases and words, which have become so colloquial, which have become co-opted by dogma, which are presented again and again in contexts that are ignorant of the language and meaning, need to be recalibrated in such a way that you as a person can know exactly what it is that you're saying and mean what you say and use words like this with precision, with accuracy. And that can be done. This education prepares you for that. That's what it's for. And it will do its stuff. We're taking Stravinsky and Schiller as a pair because in a very realistic way, Schiller and Stravinsky together form a kind of parentheses. They form a parentheses around the 19th century. Schiller dies in 1905. He was only 44 years old. Stravinsky was born in 1882. He's very much a 19th century fellow, as you will see. They are the parentheses, and the 19th century is characterized by the progressive dematerialization of the physical world. At the beginning of the 19th century comes this kind of certainty that facts will hold, that reality is something you can tap and you can be damn well practical and sure. Kind of the ultimate icon of that sort of thing is the image of a Samuel Johnson with his corpulent body resting with opinions that were very certain on his chair. Whereas at the end of the 19th century, one comes across one of the most practical men who ever lived, a Scotsman named James Clerk Maxwell, who in the 1870s was working out the mathematical equations for electromagnetism. And he was absolutely shocked that they mathematically were quite accurate, that what you could tap was not really the arbiter of reality. That what you can tap is but a temporary focus of vibrations of electromagnetism, and they could very easily reabsorb what you could tap without batting an eye. And just because something like a proton lasts for 20 billion years doesn't mean that it's objectively eternal. All constituent things dissolve. When one is looking to see the 19th century, by bookending it with Schiller and Stravinsky, one puts into perspective a massive dematerialization, but also a massive disenchantment. Because at the very beginning of the 19th century, in the 1790s, one has in Europe this flavor that anything could be done. It was like springtime in the mind. They had the successful example of the American Revolution before them. By the 1790s, it was quite certain that the United States had come out of its revolutionary position as at least an equal to European countries. It was there. Whether Washington would be a king or a president was still a moot point, but it had emerged. The French took that as a cue, but took it in a French way, not to break free from like a British colonial yoke. No, the French are much more universal and basic than that. They wanted to break humanity free from the colonial yoke of history. So in the French Revolution, when they were successful, they renumbered the calendar. The French Revolutionary calendar read year one. Historical time was boxed up and set away. This is year one. And the following year was year two. They redated time. They redated history. Chronology began completely anew. And people like Blake and Shelley, Schiller, Goethe were singing the praises of man freed at last, because the French Revolution, even more than the American Revolution, was the flower of a whole movement that took a whole century to develop, the Enlightenment. That the French Revolution showed that the Enlightenment could not just apply to a few bright guys, not just to a Voltaire or a Franklin, but could apply to a whole millions of population of people like the French people. And within a year or so of the success of that, the flower of the Enlightenment not only wilted but stank. The French Revolution degenerated like that into what's called the historical period in French history as the Terror. That's what they call it. They still call it that. Anybody who was accused by the mob was killed. They were not just killed secretly, they were guillotined publicly. So that the women and children and men with their bread and cheese and sausages munching in the sun could watch justice pick off what was dispensable. So they began to accuse each other. No one can knit a scarf that long to encompass that kind of madness. And people like Schiller soured, but soured in such a titanic way, because how could this happen? How could the most brilliant movement in human history, the Enlightenment, successfully culminate and completely wilt utterly so fast? What in hell was wrong? What is it? And in this turmoil of the late 1790s, early 1800s, when this was happening, Schiller put together a philosophy of civilization in a series of letters called the Aesthetic Letters, or On the Aesthetic Education of Man. He wanted to put this in a form that no one would mistake as transpersonal or impersonal, but could understand that it was personal. Letters are from someone to someone else. They're person to person. Whereas the archetype of symbolic mental understanding in the Enlightenment were not letters, but they were essays. The archetype of the Enlightenment essay was from the early 17th century Francis Bacon. Francis Bacon's form of the essay. And in the Enlightenment, it was developed. We now would call such a thing technically a dissertation. A dissertation is a reasoned argument which can be defended against critics and detractors. An essay is meant to convince you permanently of an intellectual position which could be taken then as a constituent of principle. So that the essay was a symbolic form of mental certainty, whereas the letter is a personal form of differential possibility. Whenever one finds a great transformational epoch that has learned to be more sophisticated than the essays of the mind, one finds personal letters. The essays of Aristotle were transcended by the letters that make up a lot of the New Testament. It's the personal guarantee that this objectivity works. It works in a conscious time space. I am telling you that you can make this work in a larger realm, that one has to be able to transform beyond the mind, further than where symbols can extend, whereas the essay has all the confidence in the mind that there is. If we get our symbols right, then we have it. And it's true that the symbols are extremely important, but the point of this whole presentation today is that symbols are a fulcrum in the middle, they're not a period at the end. The Nazis think that the symbols are the last punctuation Whereas the symbols are but the invisible fulcrum upon which the whole teeter-totter must find a balance and an equilibrium. If symbols do not balance, they tyrannize. Symbols that run away with us regress us. We must be in control of the way in which symbols are used. Otherwise, symbols use us out of control. In ancient India, the swastika was a symbol of the dynamic movement of nature, of the seasons, out of which one saw that there was an unmoving pivot in the center. Whereas the Nazi swastika was a final imprimatur of the power of the state, which so much transcended your feeble capacities that you better listen up permanently, is a completely different use of the same kind of process. And yet when one looks at the Nazi swastika, you can see that it's the backwards version of the ancient Buddhist swastika. Actually goes back to Central Asia. The Buddha never claimed to be innovated. He said it's ancient, timeless wisdom. It's always rediscoverable. This quality of Schiller and Stravinsky giving us a parenthesis of a 19th century, where Schiller reaches back through the whole Enlightenment all the way back to the beginnings of it, and Stravinsky reaches forward into the 20th century. He lived into the early 1970s. Stravinsky and Schiller give us together, by bookending the 19th century, they give us the 18th and 20th century also, so that we get 300 years of formative development, which is a setting which we have had to live with. We have been born into it, we have struggled with it, and we come from a situation that so outclasses us in terror that most people seek the only solace that's available, and that is not to think about it. Don't tell me about it. Let them handle it. Well, as they say in television land of the 1950s, guess what? There's no they there. The category is vacant. It's blank. It's not occupied. When you look to see what kind of audience is there that's watching over us, the seats are empty. But so deep is the need that one sees that the seats are occupied by aliens, beneficent or not, or yogis, supposed or not, or demons or angels, depending upon your temperament. If one takes the discipline to its zero point, if one retracts all the projective energies, and you look with that clear eye of the farmer who has just plowed the whole damn field, you can see there's not a plant growing. There's no one in the seats. There aren't even any seats there. If you're going to get to shore, you're going to have to learn to swim. And that's where an education comes in. An education is great because it shows you something that you might have forgotten, that you have an infinite capacity to learn. That whatever it is that we are, we can learn infinitely. And we can learn infinitely from scratch. We can start from a vanishing point and come back into possession of a cosmos. Is it godlike? Let's leave the like off. Let's even leave the God off. It's just provable because you yourself can do it. It was the confidence of Schiller that this was so, He was so confident he wrote a poem called The Hymn to Joy, which Beethoven set to music. It's called the Ninth Symphony. It was so certain that Stravinsky, even not wanting to be able to believe that of himself, still did it time and time again. One of the great things about art is that it is the objectivity of the spiritual person in a conscious time space who can reach out and make the stars dance into a cosmos. To the apes, the stars are just a part of the wallpaper of the world. But to an artist who can see the constellations and the patterns, one can learn to pick out even something so refined as a point of light, almost out of physical eyesight, in a group of stars called Ursa Minoris, the Little Bear, and the least bright star in the Little Bear, Zeta Ursa Minoris, has a planetary system, which was just discovered last month. To know that is a freedom. Not only will no ape ever know that, they'll never believe it even if you could tell them. And apes are much closer to the tribal level than we are. Let's take a break. Let's come back to Scheller and Stravinsky. Let's come back to art. Back to this whole affair. We get distracted by surprise and sensation because they're made to distract. But if you develop a taste for the sugar and the salt of surprise and sensation, you miss the subtle nuances of flavor that are there in transformation. Surprise is not a transformation. And very often, when one is stuck, when one is in a stuck frame of reference, it's just like the experience that used to be when films were shown on projectors and they would have these dirty gates and the film would get stuck and the image on the screen would shudder and finally the film burn out and snap. That's called a mental breakdown. And the shuddering is like the anxieties of neuroses. And one should be neurotic because you're trying to run a film in your mind instead of living your life. Anyone living open in conscious time space never has those problems because there's no film, there's no gate, there's no projection, there's no screen, and you don't need an audience. Part of the difficulty of tyrants is that they're always acting in front of a universal audience, which is their imagined applause from those people who understand the principles by which they're defending their right to tell you what to do. This kind of acting is the worst sort of ham. Why does this happen? Schiller, in his very first letter, writes this. I believe I can show. Once divested of their technical form, they stand revealed as the immemorial pronouncements of common reason and of data, as data of that moral instinct which nature in her wisdom appointed man's guardian until, through the enlightenment of his understanding, he should have arrived at years of discretion. But it is precisely this technical form whereby truth is made manifest to the intellect, which veils it again from our feeling. For alas, Intellect must first destroy the object of inner sense if it would make it its own. Like the analytical chemist, the philosopher can only discover how things are combined by analyzing them, only lay bare the workings of spontaneous nature by subjecting them to the torment of his own techniques. In order to lay hold of the fleeting phenomena, he must first bind it in the fetters of rule, tear at its fair body to pieces by reducing it to concepts, and preserve its living spirit in a sorry skeleton of words. Is it any wonder that natural feeling cannot find itself again in such an image? Or that in the account of the analytical thinker, truth should appear always as paradox? This is 200 years ago. It's already very well understood. As long as one confuses integration and differentiation, those two modes together, it's like mixing matter and antimatter. If they would come into contact, they would mutually cancel each other out by a huge explosion. End of all existence. So they never touch, so they always displace each other. So that one's complete sense of reality always has a quality of balance, which to the naive or the childlike first approaching it, it seems ironic or peculiar or odd. And as one gets more acquaintance with it, it seems paradoxical or peculiar or metaphorical. And only after a while, when you get used to the amplitude of reality, that you settle down and you live very comfortably. It's not that they ever reconcile as coming together as one integral lump. That's a very poor therapy. It's a very poor inner helper who's an integral focus exclusively of everything. One never experiences the differential mode at all. For when the differential mode comes into play, it exchanges that kind of synthesizing quality which the integral naturally has. Only when the differential consciousness comes into play, its synthesis is not to reduce down, but to open out. The term synthesis not only means that you bring two things together, like in a Hegelian thesis, antithesis, synthesis, it's not only that you bring together, but you can synthesize in making variants indefinitely of something. So that a great artist, like let's take Johann Brahms. Brahms takes a theme from Joseph Haydn, and he makes variations on a theme of Haydn. And one can listen to Haydn and appreciate Haydn, and one can listen to Brahms' variations of him, and you do not hear Haydn, you hear Brahms. And but you can appreciate that also. And had he wanted to go on, Brahms could have made infinite variations. The differential consciousness of the artist is free. He, she lives in freedom. Freedom is not a hopeful principle by which you live. It's one of the dimensions of the real by which you actually do live. Freedom is a constituent dimensionality of the human person. And to the extent that that's compromised, what is it compromised by? Not by other people's freedom. Your freedom is not compromised by other people's freedom. When one really understands that, Freedom has nothing to do with freedom of choice. One is given a series of multiple choices and you choose one. Well, and if somebody chose something else on the list, therefore there's a conflict. It's a complete, total, utter misunderstanding. Freedom is a differential resonance. And everyone's freedom in differential resonance has a proportional quality that's characteristic of melodic harmony. To use, for a moment, musical language. So that even when somebody like Stravinsky is talking about the importance of dogma, setting principles, which are limitations, he never forgets the first quality of music is the melody, the melodic line. And after the tremendous accolades of Stravinsky, the Rite of Spring, Petrushka, the Firebird, revolutionary, Stravinsky takes great pains to point out, no, I'm not a revolutionary. Innovation is not in revolution. But innovation is in developing the melodic line, and then he says, of a dogma. Students at Harvard didn't want to hear it. He repeated it. Here's how he speaks of it, and the culmination of it is a composition known as Mavra. It's an opera. Here's how Stravinsky begins. He says it's a great honor to occupy the Charles Eliot Norton Chair of Poetics. It had been occupied by people like E.E. Cummings, who delivered a series of six lectures there that you can still find in print, which are just a jewel. Cummings was the kind of poet who was just masterful at the differential consciousness. He wrote a fantastic poetic novel called The Enormous Room, about how an artist lives in a universe that is so vast that no one can find the walls. And how in this enormous vast room there are always adversaries who want to interrogate you. And how the best way to respond to such interrogation is to claim that you're not who they think you are. They have the wrong person. Aren't you so-and-so? Well, yes, I was known as that occasionally. Don't you live so-and-so? Yes, I've lived there among other places, etc. When people, critics said, well, we don't understand Mr. Cummings' Enormous Room, then he wrote an epic stream of consciousness novel called Amy, which is Greek for I am, which outdoes Finnegan's Wake by light years. It's no longer in print because no one could read it, including the university critics who make a living writing commentaries on things like Finnegan's Wake, whereas Amy by E.E. Cummings blows it out. Who do you think I am? And when? And why? And let's have fun tossing that around, because I hold the same view of you. And it's just as wrong, isn't it? It's like that. So Stravinsky found himself in the company of people like E.E. Cummings occupying this chair of poetry. And he talks about them. And he's not really an academic, but what he wants to talk about is musical poetics and how poetics, the very term comes from the Greek, he says it's from the Greek poiein, which means to make, to do, to make. Actually, his Greek is a little impaired. The correct term is poiesis rather than poiein. And poiesis is not only to make, but it's to create. He's trying to sidestep the whole issue of creativity here. He's trying to found it on making, on a doing. And that's fine, because that's how Aristotle founds it too. And Stravinsky follows Aristotle. And it's very easy to follow Aristotle and confuse the way in which mystical differential consciousness creates something new with the reliance of the certainty of ritual doing on principle of mental understanding, which then gives a formal form to the ritual doing. And that's very Aristotelian. But there's a whole differential cosmos of non-Aristotelian. My friend Van Vogt wrote a whole series of science fiction stories and the world of Nulle, non-Aristotelian thought. Why is it that Aristotle's formal, principled control of doing gets so easily confused with the spiritual, transcendent, mystical creation of differential persons? The reason why, and it was never confused in classical antiquity, never. The reason is that after the fall of the civilization of classical antiquity, when the chairs of learning were demanded and acquired by Roman-minded Christian clerics who didn't understand very much of anything, they forgot the integrity of writings to maintain their form, and they confused some pages of Aristotle with some pages of Plotinus. Can you imagine confusing pages from Plotinus with pages of Aristotle? And they mixed them together in the 6th century AD, and they said, well, this is a treatise called Isagoge, and it was the foundation of medieval classical high learning. So they mixed the differential consciousness of Plotinus with the analytical formalism of Aristotle together in one manuscript, which they said, this is the law, this is the principle, this is what the ancients said. And so the confusion lasted all the way until 1997. No way. They don't mix. The first person to be able to look at that manuscript and draw a question to it was Ficino in the Renaissance, because he read Greek well enough to see that this doesn't read like Aristotle. This is somebody else. And a great later development of that capacity was Erasmus, who could read Greek better than anybody since Plotinus. And he said, do you know what? Not only have they confused the Isagoge between two different authors, but what passes as the New Testament is filled with editorial interpolations. All these things are written in completely different styles, different grammar, different persons. What we have here are crib notes of maybe 24 people parading as so-and-so. And that fomented what was called the Reformation. That the Bible was a pastiche. And if that's God's word, he better learn grammar. You get that? That was 500 years ago. What I'm saying to you is something that Ficino or Erasmus or even Plotinus would have said to you were they in this position. The whole civilization that we inhabit is a pastiche that never had a basis in reality. Nothing in this culture or civilization or personality is real. It is all made up, it is all provisional. It's all scotch taped together. It's a pastiche from beginning, middle, and end. So what that we have to start from scratch? It's better to start from scratch and have something that's real rather than go around with masks that are for festivals that never happened in the first place, never in antiquity. Why is the world in the condition that it's in? Because no one is real. Not only are the seats empty, for the audience, but the stage is empty of anyone doing anything for real. Why have human beings not been to the moon for 25 years when they could go there 25 years ago? There's no one there because there's no reality. There's no one there to go there. That's why. Why did no Soviets ever go to the moon? Because the Soviets were such a made-up, false pastiche of so-called civilization that it had no basis in reality whatsoever. You can orbit the Earth with a pastiche, but you can't leave it and go anywhere. It's the universal principle. One of the old-fashioned, forgotten phrases of magical wisdom is that everything sublunary belongs to the world. Everything superlunary belongs to God. The chief don't brook no imposters. That's very bad grammar, very good sense. Stravinsky, occupying the chair of poetics at Harvard, is trying to impress the students at Harvard in a time when the Nazis were taking over the world that you can't just wing it in art. And so he goes overboard about being formulaic. The formulaic quality, he says here, to bring order out of chaos, to extricate the straight line of our operation from the tangle of possibilities, from the indecision of vague thoughts, presupposes the necessity of some sort of dogmatism. I use the words dogma and dogmatic then only insofar as they designate an element essential to safeguarding the integrity of art and mind. And I maintain that in this context, they do not usurp their function. The very fact that we have recourse to what we call order, that order permits us to dogmatize in the field we are considering, not only develops our taste for dogmatism, it incites us to place our own creative activity under the aegis of dogmatism. That is why I should like you to accept the term. As a peculiar paradoxical instance of someone revolting against the Nazis speaking exactly the way in which they spoke. If you serve the state well, the German people will reward you by letting you live. The dogmatism reduces down very quickly to a very brief statement. I myself have been in rooms interrogated, oddly enough, and they always have recourse to the same kind of language, like Cummings' enormous room. They always tell you that it will be very nice for you if you cooperate. And they tell you also that it will be very bad for you if you don't. That's essentially what is said. The ego says that to your spirit. The ego says to your spirit, if you quit this foolishness of trying to be completely open and create things, if you settle for something which is really firm and provable, like doing practical things and thinking clear thoughts, which we will orchestrate for you because we want everything for your own good. We're doing this to protect you. If you give up this taste for infinite exploration of the eternal and settle for safe and sound obedience, then we will take care of you. The ego says you won't be tormented anymore by any anxieties. There'll be no phobias, there'll be no fears. Not only will you fit in, but you will be glad to fit in. And that's the way that they talk. We live in a time when no one can stand to hear that, and yet everyone lives that way. And so it's an absurd situation across the board. Here, 1939, Stravinsky at Harvard goes on to develop in the most curious, paradoxical way, the freedom of the artist in face of accepting a dogmatic tandem between mind and the ritual action, the body. Now, in order to understand the three different objectivities, classical wisdom used to speak of the body, which is the ritual objectivity, the mind, which is the symbolic objectivity. Look at that. The old blessing thing, right? And third, the spiritual objectivity of the heart. Body, mind, heart. Three different objectivities. And while the body and the mind can have a split, where would they have a split? The only way to split the body and the mind is to have a fracture in the mythic level, the mythic process. Only when the mythic process is fractured do body and mind fall into opposition. But when the mind and the heart do not have a harmony, we don't say that there's a split between the heart and the mind. We say that they are not reconciled. We use the other side of that stereotype language. You have to reconcile the heart and the mind, but you have to heal the split between the mind and the body. So notice here, in both cases, the common denominator, the central term repeated in both, is the mind. Symbols. Symbols are where the problem comes into view. But there's a great compromising fact that devastates someone who would try to figure it out in terms of the mind. Even though the mind is there at the focus, even though symbols are there at the focus, the symbols belong to the differential cycle of integration and don't go overboard until they make a transformation. It's very difficult to understand this until you once see it, and once you see it, you wonder how you could have ever missed it. A transformation, going beyond the form. A form has to have a shape, otherwise it isn't a form. Any shape that has its formal form has a center. It has a center of location, a center of gravity, it has a center of composition as a center. If you want to go from one form to another form, if you want a transformation, you don't deform this form to get it to fit this new form or other form. Transformation is not deforming. It's trans. It's shifting. It's shifting what? It's shifting. It's exchanging centers. This form and this form exchange centers. It's like impregnation. So that now the set of the two forms operate together very harmoniously because they operate with each other's centers in their place. So that the whole principle of reality now is not the point, but the harmony. So that the whole calibration of what's real is not the focus, but it's the melody and it's harmonic. One then has a harmony, which is the cosmos, that doesn't at all obviate nature from being pointillistic. Nature can have its little ritual reign of existential points. Atoms can be atoms, molecules can be molecules, things can be things. So that existential pointillism still is free to happen out of the incessant movement of nature. But just as nature is an incessant movement, a matrix of change always, the cosmos is a real thing. The objectivity of the cosmos is so real that the cosmos has a personality. Heaven has a personality. The entire form of the cosmos, large as it is, infinite as it is, nevertheless has a personality, which the spiritual person recognizes and feels that the cosmic person recognizes them. It's not a question of believing in God so much as meeting, getting acquainted. Oh, how do you do? And that's how it goes. So it's a whole different point. It's not how well you argue points of dogma. It's did you meet the person who's at home? It's a whole different ecology of understanding. It has a completely different readout then, and the calibration of what makes good sense suddenly has a different configuration. But a configuration which is very familiar to us, because it's a configuration that's there when the baby first smiles at the mother. The baby can't draw a portrait of the mother, but the baby in the bassinet knows its mother. There's no mistake whatsoever. Anybody else comes to tickle the feet, powder the butt, chuck the chin, the smile is a little different. The mother is there. Hiya. In whatever way that baby can say it. And then later on, when they can talk, they don't never confuse their mother with somebody else. Her. That's the same way with the divine. There's no confusion whatsoever. It's like waking up to that person who makes reality happen. Right there. You don't have to worry about whether you got the arguments of the scholastic dogma straight at all. They're irrelevant. They don't make any difference at all. Even somebody who's completely wrong, it's even kind of funny because being completely wrong, they're closer to the truth. Because they have so many opportunities to realize how stupid they are that the chances are very good that in the next hour that they're going to say, geez, that's not quite right, is it? And then you have the good graciousness to say, well, I don't know, what do you think? It's like that kind of a thing. There's a quality, and Stravinsky gets very close to it because he's a very great artist. Is a tremendous artist. But what Stravinsky is getting at here comes out in a very peculiar paradox. The point of his whole first lecture at Harvard in the Poetics of Music is to get acquainted and to disclose to them that the most important realization in his artistic life had come about two decades earlier, when he was writing the musical piece, Mavra, because he realized, let's go to a quotation. Let's get it straight. There's a big two-volume set of books on Stravinsky, just the Russian period. It's about 2,000 pages, published by University of California Press. And on page 1,584 comes this really brilliant little assessment of what we could call a crux in the paradox of Stravinsky. It's headlined in the book in capital letters, "Bringing Things Full Circle, : What Was Anti-Modernism?" Because Stravinsky is not only a, quote, revolutionary in music, and ushering in a whole modern culmination, but he also was the great example of neoclassicism, which was against modernism totally. So he's both and, which is one of the great peculiarities of Stravinsky. You wouldn't think that such a little physical form could hold so much energy because he was embodying a dichotomy. He was a very good Catholic. He wrote musical compositions towards the end of his life that were to fit in and become new paradigms. Yet he also wrote musical compositions that completely, smilingly transcend all of that stuff permanently. You can hear it both. Here's what is written on this page, page 1594. It reminds me of, there's a little sequence in Howard Hawks' science fiction film, The Thing, and the crew is flying in this airplane, and they're talking about UFOs, and the guy says, well, here in this Air Force bulletin's number, it says that they're just illusions. And the co-pilot says, what was that number of that? And he reads it again, this long number. He says, oh, that one. Ah. This is not my language, but this is scholarly language. But it convey, I've excerpted it, so it will convey to you a very peculiar point, an extraordinarily peculiar point. It's a fulcrum of the conundrum of symbols condensed in the example of Stravinsky and his work. How can someone who is so differentially creative that he's one of the geniuses of the 20th century be so dogged about dogma at the same time? Viewed solely in terms of its sources, its idiom, and its tone, Mavra seems hardly more than a melange of amiably antiquated sundries, waltzes, polkas, sentimental ditties, and miscellaneous musique. Why, then, did Stravinsky excitedly refer to the work in progress as a masterpiece and the best thing I've ever done? What were the musical ideas he had completely, quote, completely succeeded in realizing? And Stravinsky wrote this at the time and later on said, this is a turning point for me. It's a monumental point in my career. Rite of Spring, monumental? No. Firebird? No. This. This? Yes. Why? Later in the Chroniques, he wrote this, that he succeeded completely to the point where they determined what, as of 1935, he could call the whole subsequent course of his work. That all of his work for decades afterwards were dominated by this. Answers to these questions have to do with matters Stravinsky himself would never discuss coherently until the Poetics of Music. This is a very formative work. It's the first time that an artist who embodied this odd conundrum, the knot and the bow at the very same time in the very same person, who in a blink of the eye could be dogmatically servient and the next blink of the eye be so creatively far out that it took decades for people to get to where they could hear the possibilities. It's only been recently that some Stravinsky could even be heard. He's fantastic. He's unbelievable. So the Poetics of Music, chief among them, was the paradigmatic after the Great War theme of defending culture against the mob. It's a great theme, the 20s and 30s. We can't let the mob dominate. Out of this you get like a book by Frank Lloyd Wright about the fighting against the mobocracy, genius and the mobocracy. Or you get an Ayn Rand Fountainhead type thing. Or the best example is in the film Things to Come, which you should find and rent and take a look at, and the restructuring of the genius of civilization out of the ashes of huge warfare that went on and on and on. And finally, they get back to the point to where they're going to send the first humans into space, and in this huge futuristic city in Things to Come, made in 1936. It's the mob that wants to destroy it. The mob who inhabit the very civilization and genius and beauty of the place in which they live do not recognize the creative flower, which is the very essence of where they live. So there was this paradigmatic, after the Great War theme of defending culture against the mob, a defense that took the form, that authoritarian and reactionary stance we now call neoclassicism. Neoclassicism. You have the classic, then you have the romantic, which is a revolution against, not the, a revolution against the classic, but against the scholastic occupation of the classic without the equilibrium. Then you have neoclassic, which is a reaction against the romantic. Stravinsky was against the romantic excesses of followers of Wagner, especially. These hacks who think that slurring these music phrases are going to give us the motifs of a Wagner just off the cuff is what we would call today Muzak, or Brian Eno used to call it airport music. It's what you hear in the background in airports. If you ever would listen, they play this kind of stuff. Elevator music. As it related to opera, the neoclassic posture, notice this ritual reference, the neoclassic posture was given its full dogmatic exposition in the third lesson of the Poetics, where, taking off from an explicit reference to Mavra, the artificialities of operatic convention are defended against the pathological vulgarism, the vulgarian depredations of music drama. It's like soap opera music, as opposed to a concert piece. The latter was condemned for its lack of tradition, for its nouveau riche smugness, and for the terrible blow and it inflicted upon music itself. It's like someone who's used to Muzak hears a musical composition, they say, I don't understand it. It's like someone used to commercials and quips and everything, and they hear a lecture like this, they say, I didn't hear anything. Well, maybe you need to sensitize. Or they hear a Mozart piece and they say, God, I saw fields of lilies, and then I saw very nice colors, and then it sort of lost me. And I, well, could you whistle the theme? What theme? Oh. No theme. Do you play an instrument? No. Do you hum? No. That's a double entendre, right? Do you hum? So in the aftermath of the Wagnerian miasma, could no longer be accepted without shame because it was purely sensual delight. Incidentally, the erotic gets smulched in here as being very bad because it smudges up the clarity of the dogma, which it should do and does in fact do. Do you think Cupid cares who he shoots his arrows at? He doesn't care at all. He doesn't care what you believe. Twang. In the second lesson, meanwhile, Stravinsky had expounded a rigorous definition of melody. Melody is the musical singing of cadenced phrase. Cadenced phrase. The musical singing of cadenced phrase. And affirmed that melody must keep its place at the summit of a hierarchy of elements that made up music. Here's this little Aristotelian hierarchy, and the top element is melody. And all these together then make music, and that then is harmony. Well, that's not quite it. It's not very Pythagorean. It's not at all Plotinian. It's very Aristotelian. It's very scholastic. And though he may have believed it, Stravinsky did not always toe those lines. Thank goodness. This was the breakthrough that he had achieved in Mavra, the rediscovery of cadenced phrase after years spent building impressive structures out of open-ended qualities. Stravinsky was very good at building compositions out of open-ended. The author uses the Russian phrase popevki. It means these open-ended musical phrases. Somebody who was really genius at that was like Tchaikovsky, when he would get fantastically into the beauty of his melodic harmonies. Like there are portions towards the end of Swan Lake where Tchaikovsky simply jumps completely off the scale in terms of musical beauty. He lets all the wings of all the notes fly free. And you get this crescendo of a ballet that, were it be able to be staged, would have to be staged in a zero gravity environment. No dancers could pirouette as beautifully freely as long as there was any gravity whatsoever. The music simply becomes celestial. There are times when a triple pirouette is clumsy next to the music that is there. The rising of feeling that dwarfs even the kind of Wagnerian phrasing that was preferred at that time by musical beauty. Stravinsky was masterful at this kind of melodic beauty. One example, his ballets Apollo and Orpheus use a cadenced phrasing in an off-the-scale Tchaikovsky kind of way. Don't pay any attention to what he says. Listen to what he composes. And if you listen, this has Odilon Redon's cover on it of The Chariot of the Sun. It's a very good recording. And as soon as you hear the opening bars, I think Apollo is the initial ballet, the opening bars of the Apollo ballet give you the cadenced phrasing that will be used through the entire piece. But the melodic way in which Stravinsky uses it weans itself not only away from ritual, but finally weans the mind away from being dependent upon ritual. And the mind goes to the next objective character in the universe, in the cosmos, and that is the differential consciousness of the artist person. So that the listener becomes an artist because they hear musically what is before them. It's a freeing event. It's like the startling recognition that Matisse had the first time that he saw color. For real. He said once he saw what color really was, that he couldn't be anything but an artist. That was it. His business career was finished because he had seen color for what it really is. He had seen it. And he felt that color, when it's really seen, is the gorgeousness of the spiritual person. What's the color spectrum of the positrons? The cosmic person can see that. More next week.